The episode you're about to hear was recorded prior to the spring budget on the 6th of March. In the episode, we discussed multiple dwellings relief, or MDR, but the Chancellor announced that this will be abolished on the 1st of June 2024. So please bear this in mind when listening to this podcast.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Private Wealth team at SAFRI. My name is Leonora Stevens. I'm a partner in the Private Wealth team based in Bristol. I'm delighted to be joined virtually by Mike Hodges, a fellow Private Wealth partner at SAFRI who's based in our Manchester office. Hello, Mike.
Hi, Leo.
Today, we are very pleased to be joined by a guest speaker, being another SAFRI partner, Elizabeth Harkness, who is based in our Private Wealth and Estates team in London. Welcome, Liz.
Hi, Leo. Hi, Mike.
Hiya.
Today, we are talking about the main considerations from both a tax and a practical perspective to think about when purchasing large residential properties and land estates. There's certainly no way that we'll manage to cover every possible consideration in this short podcast, but we wanted to give you a whistle-stop tour of what we see as being the key things you need to be aware of and to plan for accordingly. So this includes funding for the purchase and how you think about structuring it, stamp duty land tax, VAT, employment taxes, you know, for example, will you be taking on any employees and any associated benefits that they're provided to them, the impact on your inheritance tax position, CGT and principal residence relief, and non-disclosure agreements. So, Liz, would you like to set the scene as to what sort of individuals or scenarios we're looking at specifically when looking at this topic and what sort of level of investment we're talking about?
Great. Thanks very much, Leo. Yeah, so where we see these sorts of purchases coming from, we might have people who've had a liquidity event in their lives and have come into a large amount of money and they've got liquid cash available to buy their dream home in the countryside. So they might have inherited money, they might have sold a business, or they might sort of be a city exec and have had carried interest come through or some other very large bonus. And this is their chance to buy that dream property in the country that they've seen in country life and so on.
And what would you see as being the first topic that should be considering, when looking to acquire that large property or land and estate?
Yeah, I suppose the key thing is, where's the money coming from for the purchase? And of course, the property agent will ask that question as well. They'll often want proof of funds from an accountant or some other professional so that they know the purchaser is able to complete on such a purchase. So thinking about funding, if the money is all in cash, then that's obviously great and very easy. But it may be that it's still tied up in some sort of business or corporate structure. So consideration needs to be made as to how to get that money out. Will there be a tax charge? Will there be timing delays, especially if it's maybe invested in the market? Are there any timings that need to be taken into account to get that into cash for completion?
What about if they haven't got cash and they use debt? What sort of things should they be considering about if they use debt financing?
Yeah, exactly. And we do see people using debt. It's not just people who necessarily need the debt. They might have the cash, but they've made a decision that actually they want to leverage the asset. It can potentially be beneficial from an inheritance tax perspective to have some debt secured. There might be other reasons why actually having a bit of debt is beneficial. If they are taking debt, then obviously you need to have your lender lined up, and lots of the property agents will have links to people who can advise on debt and make introductions there, or your accountant might also know people. And then it's really about thinking about the debt. How, if you are securing debt, how is that actually secured? Is it secured on the asset as a whole, or is it potentially being secured on certain parts? It may just be being secured on the residential property, if that's what the lender is particularly comfortable with, as opposed to all the land and other buildings, which, I mean, as you can imagine, lenders probably are more interested in assets that they think have got the best security. So anything that's a bit funny on the land, they might not be so interested in securing the debt on that. And in particular, what it's secured on then also does have an impact on what you can get tax relief for in terms of interest deductions. If it's secured just on residential property, you might be able to have some interest relief on that if it's let property, but there are now restrictions on how much tax relief you can get on that. If it's secured on business land, potentially if there's any sort of farming element, you might be able to get a greater deduction of interest on that or on some commercial properties, but it really does need looking at to ensure you know what the interest deduction position is.
Those were the interest rates we've had recently, and the high amount of interest that people have been paying. If they can get tax relief for it, it could be really valuable. So hence why it's important to get the structure of that debt so that it's in the right place. Mm-hmm. But then looking also, I suppose, at SDLT, stamp duty land tax, and I know that it's a really complex area, but that's also something people should be considering, isn't it?
Absolutely. And lots of property agents, I'm sure, when people first go and look around these properties, they will float the potential that there might be a lower rate of SDLT because either the asset might be classified as non-residential, depending on exactly what you're buying, or it might also qualify for something called multiple dwellings relief, which applies in several situations, but probably the most common one that people might have seen is where you're sort of acquiring a big house with some sort of annex attached to it. And there's been quite a lot of case law in this area. If you're potentially buying an even bigger sort of property, more of a traditional sort of estate where you might have a few cottages, then you are further into this multiple dwellings situation, which, as the sort of name suggests, is where you are buying multiple dwelling occupations. And there's basically a comparison that can be done to work out which relief is the better one to claim. Is it multiple dwellings relief, or might it be the mixed use non-residential rate? And so basically, that, as you said, Leo, the headline thing is please do take some SDLT advice. And this is an area that HMRC are scrutinising. It's quite an easy area for them to go after because the transactions are obviously high value and so flag up on their radar, and the amount of SDLT at stake makes it worthwhile for them looking into each one. So if you are putting in a claim for a lower rate of SDLT because it's non-residential or it's multiple dwellings, you can pretty much guarantee you will get an inquiry from HMRC. There is a time limit for them to do that. And in our experience, people usually get an inquiry through within sort of a week of the deadline expiring. So please be prepared for that. If it's not one of those reliefs, then you're into just the normal sort of residential SDLT, which I think most people are familiar with. And the main thing to think about there is, are you acquiring a second home or are you replacing your main residence? So it's the distinction between maybe someone's been living in the city, working super hard for a bank or investment firm, and now they are relocating to the countryside. They've had their exit. They're replacing their main residence. That's a different situation for SDLT, as opposed to just buying a second home in the country that you're going to use for weekends and holidays.
And there is the time to reclaim it. If you haven't sold the first, you can still have two and then reclaim the additional surcharge.
Exactly.
Subject to various conditions, obviously.
Yes, but exactly.
We do have, as Liz has mentioned, but we do have a very strong SDLT team in-house. So if people have any queries, that's an area that we can obviously advise on. But then looking sort of, obviously, stamp duty land tax, an interesting one. We can look at another fun area being VAT. Now, for land estates, this is quite an area of interest. And sort of, what would you say are the top considerations? And you noted when we had our pre-meeting for the podcast about a top tip that people should think about when renovating a property in VAT.
Yes, that one is extremely valuable, actually. So if a property has been unoccupied for 2 years or more, you can get a lower rate of VAT, 5% rather than 20%. And interestingly, it is 2 years of that building being unoccupied as opposed to 2 years of your ownership and the building being unoccupied. So if you are buying a property that's already been empty for 12, 18 months, perhaps the previous owner went into a care home and their executives and estate have been getting it sold. If it's already been empty for 18 months, and actually if you then complete and you wait another 6 months so that 2 year period has been met, you are then into the lower rate of VAT being 5%, which is obviously a considerable saving if you're spending a lot of money renovating. It is worth taking specific VAT advice, because if you've got a building contractor managing your renovation, it's basically their risk of charging the wrong rate of VAT. So if you're telling them this qualifies for 5%, they will, I would have thought, want some sort of clear advice or clear evidence that they are right to charge you 5% as opposed to 20%. So it is worthwhile making sure you've got a really good body of evidence to back that up. And especially because getting that evidence after you've completed and your vendor has got their money, it can be quite tricky to go back to them and try and get evidence that it had been unoccupied for 18 months when you bought it. So definitely that's worth getting your lawyers to try and get that body of evidence when you're going through all the legal paperwork.
Hugely valuable. And what about with buying an estate? When you're thinking about VAT?
Yeah, one of the key questions that will always be asked is it opted? has any of the land been opted to tax? I will not go into what that means on this call because we could spend hours on it. But broadly, it's the key question to ask. If any of the land has been opted, what that broadly means is that the vendor is going to have to charge you VAT when they sell it. And so there's something you can do, which is called falling within a TOGC, transfer of going concern, which basically means that you register for VAT before completing, and therefore you are registered for VAT. When the completion happens, the vendor doesn't have to charge you VAT because you're already VAT registered. And so you basically don't have a cash flow disadvantage of having to pay VAT and then claiming it back. So it's just one of those easy things to make sure you've done. And certainly if you find out as part of your pre-purchase inquiries that any of the land is opted, then you should definitely get some VAT advice.
Minefield, isn't it? Lots to think about. In the introduction, I briefly covered the point about employment matters and, you know, if you're buying a large property or an estate. So what would you see as being the key areas to consider relating to employment?
Yeah, so depending on the size of the estate, you probably will need some help with maintenance, keeping upkeep of the garden and the grounds. Depending on, you might have some equestrian perhaps, and you want to have people to look after the horses. And if you're going to be running sheep, you might be a gamekeeper and that sort of thing. So sometimes there are employees who worked on the estate for, it might be decades, and there was a sort of an expectation that you're taking them on. But obviously that is subject to what the buyer wants to. But if you are going to be taking over any employees, then it's worth sort of understanding what their current contract arrangements are. In particular, are they provided with accommodation at the moment? If they are, there can be a whole raft of tax implications of that. Back in the day, it probably was quite traditional for people to have a cottage in the grounds on the estate. And so you might have someone who's always had a cottage, and that's just an expectation. But the rules have changed in recent years. And so it really is worth just checking whether there is a benefit in kind for that employee if they're going to continue to be provided with accommodation. If there is a benefit in kind, then clearly there's a discussion to be had as to, well, actually, how is that going to be met? Is the employee going to pay that tax, or is it going to be sort of grossed up by the employer? It's also worth thinking about what their role is going to be, and especially if you have got any sort of business element. So if there is some farming, potentially, you know, a groundskeeper could be doing elements of farming work and elements of just upkeep to the garden around the house. So if there are business activities that they're doing, then some of their remuneration might be deductible against the profits that business is making. But it is just, you know, you don't want people doing a timesheet, but it is worthwhile having some kind of, whether it's in their contract, something that says what their role is and roughly how much time they're spending on each part.
And obviously, if people, you know, I know people's initial idea is not to sort of, when they buy it, think about selling it. But how will buying the second property or their main new home impact their CGT and principal residence relief
position? Yeah, exactly. As you alluded to, it does depend on, is this a second home or is it replacement of the main house? If we assume it's a second home, then it is likely that there might be capital gains at the end if it is ever sold. Obviously, if people hold things until their death, then at the moment there's no capital gains tax on that. But yeah, so if there is going to be capital gains at the end, worth having that in mind. And in particular, it's really good if you know you're going to be doing renovations and it's a property where there's likely to be capital gains at the end, keeping a really good record of what you've spent on the renovations so that you can hopefully deduct some of those costs against any future gain. I mean, sadly, you might end up in a position whereby actually there is no gain because you've spent so much renovating on capital improvements that there is no gain at the end, which is hopefully not where you end up. But if you hold it for a long time, there probably will be a gain.
Yeah.
And so you are into, oh, sorry, Mike.
No. I was just going to say this. I've got a client I saw a fortnight ago, and I've set them homework of finding out 15 years worth of expenditure and going through records for exactly that purpose to work out what enhancement expenditure there is. And I don't think they thanked me at the end of that meeting. It can be a lot of work, can't it?
Yeah, it's really painful. I mean, hopefully if it's a big renovation project, there's probably a building contractor or project manager who's managing everything. Yeah. And so just making sure that they're doing really good record keeping and having an eye on, is something a capital enhancement or is it just a basic repair? It's really worth doing it in the moment whilst everything is fresh in the memory.
Yeah.
I suppose if you're doing it for VAT as well, anyway, hopefully you'll have the records all to hand. But I think people often don't realise the importance of keeping their paperwork. And, you know, with email, sometimes is it 7 years, they sort of can wipe off the system. So it's quite important to try and keep that record saved on a hard drive somewhere.
And Leo mentioned about if it is someone's replacement of a main home, then they should hopefully be able to claim something called PPR on that, which is principal private residence relief, and is the capital gains tax exemption that applies when you sell your main home. There are quite a few cases and requirements around this. So things like the permitted area around the house, if the grounds are too big for the sort of average person on the street would consider for reasonable enjoyment of that property, then some of that land might not be covered by PPR. And there is also special rules around when you take up occupation. If you've got a period at the beginning where you're doing a big renovation project, such a period of non-occupation might get taken into account, and you have to sort of pro rata any gain across the time that the property has been held and look at periods of unoccupation, basically. So PPR can be quite fiddly if it's not a plain vanilla situation of selling one main home, buying another, moving straight into it and living there for the whole time. That's your dream simple situation. Anything a bit funny needs looking at. And you can also do what's called PPR election whenever there's a change in the number of residences. So it's worthwhile just talking to your accountant about that and making sure that that election is made.
I don't think I've ever had an easy PPR election inquiry from a client. There's always something about whether you can, previously when you rented it, you lettings relief of up to £40,000, but that's not available anymore. But it's all about the periods of occupation, when maybe you were overseas and sort of things like that. So there's lots of, we could probably have a whole podcast on PPR relief anyway, with all the complexities around that.
And for us in the north, it's comparing likely property price increases, London versus Cheshire is the most recent one I've had.
Yeah.
It's never simple. And as you were saying, permitted area, Liz, a client of mine saying, I think that meadow is allowed and it's within. And I didn't then say, how much is it? And when we got the inquiry, I found out it was 70 acres. He thought, that's way more than I thought. So you then get into trying to justify yourself after the event. So it's much better. My experience is just make sure you're clear on terms of what is reasonable enjoyment and what, because 70 acres was always going to be pushing the point.
Yeah, definitely.
And so the other tax we haven't really looked at is about inheritance tax. So if you're buying either a big estate or a big residential property, is there any way you can structure the purchase to improve your position?
Broadly speaking, no, it's very hard to avoid inheritance tax on residential property that you're using yourself. As you can imagine, the rules have been drafted and frequently tightened up in this area. This is was key asset, so it's the key IHT revenue generator for the government. But where you are acquiring maybe more of a typical landed estate with lots of things going on, like a bit of farmland and so on, there are things that can be done. If there is any sort of business or agricultural property, there are specific reliefs for business property relief and agricultural property relief. So it's worth having a thought to those and maybe getting a bit of advice about, can the holding be structured in such a way that those reliefs should apply? I mean, you could have a whole podcast on business property relief and agricultural property relief, but there are things that can be done to look at the estate in the whole, and you might be able to sort of have some residential cottages brought in if there's a significant amount of farmland and other business activities going on. There's some case law that sort of looks at the whole position as one business entity, and if it qualifies, then you would potentially get business property relief on the whole holding, and that can be hugely valuable. There, you do then need an eye in terms of how that's structured. We see quite a few partnerships on the landed estate side. It might be sort of husband and wife, or it might actually be first generation and then next generation coming in partnership together and running a business, an estate business is one. There are lots of things that can go wrong with partnerships, and it's definitely worth, again, taking advice. And it very, you know, can be very complicated. The particular type of partnership you can see is an LLP, a limited liability partnership. And this has the added benefit of having limited liability. So if you're running maybe more of a sort of, if you've got a big house that you're acquiring and you think actually that could be quite good for a wedding venue or something, then if you're going to be having access by the public to areas of the land, having some limited liability can be a really good idea, especially if you've got maybe a well-known purchaser or someone who, you know, if they're Googled, people might think, oh, they've got loads of money. Let's, you know, have an accident on the estate and sue them for lots of money. So having limited liability can be valuable, and that would apply to a company as well. But the quid pro quo for that is that the more limited liability you've got, probably the greater disclosure you've got in the public domain of things like accounts and so on. So in terms of privacy, that's where we quite often see clients go, yes, I can see the liability argument, but from a privacy perspective, I'd rather just have a basic partnership rather than a limited liability partnership.
The point about sort of APRB, sort of farming partnership, I have a lot of clients looking at that at the moment with respect to BALFA, which is to do with whether your business is sort of mainly or wholly trading. But obviously the downside to that is ordinarily the main house won't be included in that, sadly, because unless it's sort of a proper working farmhouse, as it were, and it's character appropriate, it's unlikely, sadly, to get that one covered under the IHT sort of exemption part, sadly.
Yeah. And just on ownership, if there is company, it's general rule of thumb, it's a terrible idea to hold any residential property, especially if you're going to use it yourself.
Yes.
Through a company, because you open yourself up to benefit in kind issues. And there's also the ATEB, the annual tax on enveloped dwellings, which applies to all residential properties worth more than £500,000, which in this day and age is easily met. And yeah, ideally you don't have to go anywhere near those reporting requirements if you can avoid it.
And then finally, when we were preparing for this podcast, you mentioned about some of your clients requesting NDAs and non-disclosure agreements. Do you want to expand on that for everyone?
Yeah, so this was where you know, potentially the buyer is in the public domain or is a public interest. Then I have seen it whereby they requested that current employees on the land, the estate, sign up to NDAs prior to them going and looking around the property, because they are sort of worried about people talking down the village pub and so on, and saying so-and-so was around looking at buying this estate, or once it is known that they are hoping to exchange and complete, just word getting out. So I have seen NDAs being put in place. It's obviously not something for the accountants, it's a legal point, but it's worth thinking about. And then going forward, if you are taking on employees, whether they're existing or new, that's the point for their employment contracts as well, is thinking about privacy.
Mike, have you got any other tidbits?
No, as you were saying that, Liz, about NDAs, up in Cheshire, I'm thinking mostly footballers and those sorts of things. And yeah. I did, in a previous life, act for an upmarket estate agent, and there it was almost a big part of their business was footballers. So all of this privacy discretion bit becomes more into play. It's not for the run of the mill, but it's out there, isn't it?
Yeah, and obviously it's a legal point as to whether it is an NDA, it's also on the wording of it. So it's worth considering.
And I suppose for most people, it's their most valuable asset or assets, isn't it? And that's why I know some of what you've said, landed estates, makes it sound very grand, but equally, it doesn't have to be at any level. For most of our clients, it's along with their business, if that's separate, it's their most valuable single asset. And therefore, it does take some thinking about and some planning, sit down with them, and the record keeping piece. I think that there's a huge amount in there, as you've said about three times. We could do a separate podcast on all of these different.
Yeah. And then actually, I was talking to a property agent a month or so ago, and I said, what's the single most thing that sort of, in terms of not where it goes wrong, but things that crop up that people weren't expecting? And he said, it's the liability side of actually how much a big house in the country costs to run and maintain, and how much you will spend on repairs and all of the other things, heating and so on. You hear people talk about it, but it's true. These houses, properties take a lot of money to keep going.
Yeah, so don't underestimate it. And I live in the countryside, and you get a whole raft of rodent activity going in and around. So it takes some getting used to.
You're selling a dream, Mike. Selling a dream.
Like you, Liz, moving into the country, you need to get your head around a whole different set of issues.
Mm. Hopefully that's provided our listeners with just a taste of things that they should consider when thinking about acquiring a high-value property or land to the States. Many of them are practical points, but need some thought before making the investment and taking that leap. So it remains for me to thank Liz and Mike today for joining me for what's been a very interesting discussion. We work with a wide range of clients. Many are UK-based and many live overseas but have interests here, whether that's property, business interests or investments. We advise individuals and families on how best to safeguard, maintain and enhance their wealth, and on the most appropriate methods of passing on that wealth to the next generation. We also help people comply with the tax rules in the UK, which can be complex. If you'd like to find out more about the services we can offer at Safri, please visit our website at www.safri.com. However, it is important for me to stress that if you're considering any of the topics discussed today, you must always take professional advice based on your individual circumstances. Thank you for listening.